Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 2nd Canto, Chapter 7, entitled Scheduled Incarnations, Text 52. Yataharo Bhagavati.
Yataharo Bhagavati.
Yataharo Bhagavati.
Yataharo Bhagavati.
Nrinam Bhaktir Bhavishyati.
Nrinam Bhaktir Bhavishyati.
Sarvatmanya Kila Dare.
Sarvatmanya Kila Dare.
Iti Sankalpya Varnya. Yata, as much as, haro, and to the personality of Godhead, Bhagavati, unto the Lord, ninam, for human beings, bhakti, devotional service, bhavishyati, become enlightened, Sarva Atmani, the absolute whole. Akila Adare, unto the summum bonum. Iti, thus. Sankalpya, by determination. Varnaya, describe. Translation. Please describe the science of Godhead with determination and in a manner by which it will be quite possible for the human being to develop transcendental devotion and service and to the personality of Godhead Hari, the super soul of every living being and the summum bonum source of all energies. Purport. Srimad Bhagavatam is the philosophy of devotional service and the scientific presentation of man's relationship with the personality of Godhead. Prior to the age of Kali, there was no need for such a book of knowledge to know the Lord and the spiritual potencies. But with the beginning of the age of Kali, human society gradually became influenced by four sinful principles, namely illegitimate connection with women, intoxication, gambling, and unnecessary killing of animals. Because of these basic sinful acts, man gradually became forgetful of his eternal relationship with God. Therefore, man became blind, so to speak, to the ultimate goal of life. The ultimate goal of life is not to pass a life of responsibility like the animals and indulge in a polished way into the four animal principles, namely eating, sleeping, fearing, and mating. For such a blind human society, in the darkness of ignorance, Srimad Bhagavatam is the torchlight to see things in proper perspective. Therefore, it was necessary to describe the science of God from the very beginning or from the very birth of the phenomenal world. As we have already explained, Srimad Bhagavatam is so scientifically presented that any sincere student of this great science will be able to understand the science of God simply by reading it with attention or simply by regularly hearing it from the bona fide speaker. Everyone's hankering after happiness in life, but it's in this age the members of the human society, blind as they are, do not have the proper vision that the personality of God is the reservoir of all happiness, because he is the ultimate source of everything, janmadi asiyataha. Happiness in complete perfection without hindrance can be achieved only by our devotional relationship with him, and it's only by his association that we can get free from distressful material conditions. Even those who are after the enjoyment of this material world can also take shelter of this great science of Srimad Bhagavatam. And they will also be successful at the end. Narada is therefore requested or ordered by his spiritual master to present this science with determination and good plan. Narada was never advised to teach the principles of Bhagavatam to earn a livelihood. He was ordered by his spiritual master to take the matter very seriously in a missionary spirit. Om Agyanati Marandasya Yanandana Salakya Shakshurin Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Nama Sri Chaitanya Manavastam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Karanayam Dadati Swapanantikam Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sri Vasari Gaura Bhaktivinoda Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. In the beginning, the universe is empty, and the Supreme Personality of Godhead expands himself into that universe and fills half of it with water. Then he rests on that water, and then from his navel appears a lotus, and on that lotus appears Lord Brahma. Lord Brahma is then, upon the direction of the Lord, performing austerity, and then begins the creative process, the secondary creation. So there is Sarga and Visarga, or the primary creation by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who creates the empty universe, and then Brahma, who is like the engineer of the universe, filling it in with so many different forms of life and different influences. So at one point, Lord Brahma is in the cause of the creation, creating forgetfulness. He has to create the influence of nescience so that the living being can forget the absolute truth. And Lord Brahma afterwards feels very unhappy about that. And it's not really that he likes to do this, but it's part of his duty. Therefore, Lord Brahma has great eagerness to bring transcendental knowledge into the universe. And that Lord Brahma then, he also heard Srimad Bhagavatam. He heard Srimad Bhagavatam. Srila Sridhar Swami, the original Bhagavatam commentator, explains that he heard Bhagavatam in the form of Chatusloki, in the form of the four verses in which the whole Bhagavatam is summarized, the four key verses of Bhagavatam. So for Brahma, that was enough. He could understand everything from that. For us, we need more explanation. Therefore, we have 18,000 verses instead of four. And even then, we don't fully get it, what to do. So whatever may be, Brahma is desiring to disseminate transcendental knowledge. Then, in order to populate the universe, Brahma manifests different suns from his mind. And all these suns are great sages. And amongst them, Narada is the principal one. So, because Narada is into transcendence. But then Narada meets Lord Brahma and worships him and points out, you are the greatest personality because you are the origin of everything. And then Lord Brahma is pointing out, no, wait a minute, I'm not the origin of everything. Rather, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the origin of everything, and I'm also dependent on him. And so he points towards the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and then points towards the Bhagavatam, because the Bhagavatam is the narrative about the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That's why it's the Bhagavat. The Bhagavat is basically what provides us information about Bhagavan, about the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, we are studying the Bhagavat, either Bhagavad Gita or Srimad Bhagavatam, because it is, these are the descriptions about the Supreme Personality of Godhead and nothing else. And that is our business. Our business is simply to relate to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, because only then are we seeing things complete, because nothing exists without the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and nothing is meaningful without the relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So in this Chatusloki Bhagavatam, the first verse is saying, Aham evasam eva gre nanyanyat satasat param, that the Lord was existing before anything else existed. Anything else emanated from Him. And the Lord also existed while everything else was there, and He also existed when everything ceased to exist. That's the first. And then, Rite ritam yat pratirana pratirat chatmani tadvitya tatmano mayam yato tamayato vasa. Then it is explained that we measure the value of everything according to its relationship with the Supreme Lord. So if something is important or not important, depending on its relationship with the Supreme Lord. And the Supreme Lord has made clear what His likes and dislikes are, and that determines the relationship. Patram puspam phalam toyam, offer me a fruit, a flower, a leaf, some water, or vegetarian items. So then that becomes valuable, because the Lord has determined that is valuable. So in this way, Bhagavatam is describing the Supreme Lord, how the Lord is expanding Himself into many forms and energies. Then the energies of the Lord are threefold. There is the internal energy, there is the marginal energy, and the external energy. So the internal energy means the spiritual world and the activity of the spiritual world, devotional service. The marginal energy, the living being, and the external energy, the material world. So the living entity is in between both. He is in between the spiritual and the material, and finds also that both these aspects are within his existence. Both are pushing for needs. It says Vaja Vegam, Manasa Krodha Vegam, Jiva Vegam, Udrapasita Vegam. The pushings of words, the pushings of mind, the pushings of anger, the pushing of tongue, belly, and genitals. All these pushings are there, and we are being pushed. Also, we're speaking about the six waves of material existence that sort of sweep up a person and push him along, right, in life. So that is birth, then old age, infirmity, disease, death. So like this, we're not free to live the life that we want. Prakriti kriyamanani guna karmani sarvasa. Rather, there's a script, and this script is just going along. And although we have so many desires in the middle of all that, I want this, I want that, I want to be here, I want to be there, I want to do all these things, but ultimately the script will determine what we are allowed to do and what we are not allowed to do. Where success will be and where will be failure. And that's... So with time we begin to realize that more and more. Because with time we see that each time in so many situations we wanted so many things, but it's not at all under our control. Prakriti kriyamani guna karmani sarvasa. All is controlled by the material energy. simply the circumstances. And sometimes we are successful and we're surprised. It was something very difficult and it worked. And everyone says, wow, you did that very expertly. Yes, yes, yes. But actually the truth is, it just happened. And just somehow or other, it just happened and was successful. Right? And other times you work so hard. You know, you work so hard and it just doesn't want to work. And it's not logical. You know, I've done it 100 times and it worked 100 times. And now it's just not working. And why not? So like this, we are in the material world, depending on the arrangement of Krishna, and who is providing things to us through the material energy. Spiritual life is different. In spiritual life, you can be sure. Right? In material life, you're never sure. You don't know. You can't be sure about anything. In spiritual life, you can be sure. Actually, the result is guaranteed. It's certain. When you engage in devotional service, success will be there. There's no etavat janma safalyam. If you want to make this life successful, then deinam yadesu, while we are now in this body, then use it in the service of Krishna. Then surely it will be successful. That is the injunction of scripture. So people think, you know, I have no time for these spiritual things. It's something, you know, I have to deal with real things, you know what I mean? Real things, like food and a place to stay. I mean, you know, got to be realistic. And I can't deal with all these ethereal type of dreamy things, you know, like God and all that. But actually, that is the real thing. And all the other thing, that sort of is all going on by the material nature. So you get your share and you can't do so much about it, although you think you can, but reality is, you know, it all produces results on its own accord. And each time we are surprised. We're surprised. How in the world could this happen? And you hear stories, how could it happen? A man shoots a bullet in the air, shoots his gun in the air whenever he's drunk, and one day he shoots and the bullet goes straight up in the sky, comes back down and goes straight into his own head. I mean, you couldn't do things like that if you wanted to. Right? I mean, it would be hard, you know, it would be hard to shoot it up and to get it to come back down. But somehow or other, by karma, all such things are possible. Are possible. Karma arranges amazing things, inconceivable things. How could it all come about? The karmic story about the man who went snorkeling in Spain far into the ocean with his flippers, you know, and there was a forest fire and one of these big helicopters came with a water tank and they scooped him up. And they threw him on the fire. And there was an article in the newspaper and I read it. And then they identified this man. It turned out he had a lobster restaurant. Just see the workings of karma. The lobsters are also throwing a life in the boiling water. He was also a life thrown on the fire. Karma. Karma catches up in so many ways. So yes, we see how that happens in the world. But it's also happening to us. And then it's more difficult. Then it's much more difficult to accept. It's too much. And how can all this happen to me? And this is just... But so, gradually, as we become situated in transcendental knowledge, we gain strength. Strength to tolerate and to deal with the material energy. Otherwise, It's too much, and we get overwhelmed. But one who has, who is well situated in transcendental knowledge, is bolstered by that. Is sort of develops some detachment through that. I mean, we know when things go wrong. Oh well, you know, that happens in the material energy. You can't take it so serious. When something or someone is, something comes to an end in this world. Oh well, that's also life. Right? So it all becomes much more relative, actually. All the big things that happen in the world, but also the big successes, they also become more relative. You know, so it's okay. So in this way, gradually, one begins to see it's not so important. The real thing that is important is our spiritual progress. Prabhupada was speaking about the cars in New York, you know, these big American cars that make these deep noises. And Prabhupada said, was imitating the noise of the cars. He said, they go here and there with neck-breaking speed, but they're not making any progress. They're not making any progress. Moving so fast, going here and there, but actually not going anywhere. Because only when we are making progress in the relationship with the Supreme Lord can we speak about making progress. Because otherwise, tasyaivahita prayate te kovido talabhyate yat brahmatam upariyada. Up in the universe, down in the universe, sometimes creating some good karma, going to heavenly planets, then sometimes creating bad karma, suffering for a while, and up and down, and up and down. So that's the material existence. So, Bhagavatam, first of all, gives us some knowledge about the material energy. And we begin to see it's not so important. And then Bhagavatam begins to show us the Supreme Personality of Godhead and how that is really important. And gradually our whole focus shifts. I'd like to bring in an analogy at this stage that in the beginning, in our spiritual life, we carefully put forward one foot towards the spiritual side of life. But all the weight remains on the material leg. Yeah. So in this way, we are interested in spiritual life, but still looking at it from the material perspective. And so then we are praying to Krishna, oh Krishna, please help me, help me. You know, I mean, my life is really, it's too much. Krishna, please help me. So this is like when the weight is still on the material leg. But with time, the weight goes more and more onto the spiritual leg, and we become more and more focused on the spiritual reality, the spiritual world, and the material world looks unimportant and temporary. And, you know, you can laugh about it, you know. It all fell to pieces. Yeah. Not so important. Because the weight is on the spiritual leg. Yeah. So gradually we move forward. And once the weight is on the spiritual leg, then our happiness is there and we really live there. And that is the advanced platform. And that is actually the reality. That is how it should be. Because we are in the spiritual world. It is in this material world we are not really there. We're only here because the spiritual world is covered by some cloud of illusion, and it seems that we are in the material world, and therefore, but actually we are not. We're actually in the spiritual world. So we see that Srila Prabhupada had that kind of consciousness and became very tolerant and sort of unaffected by material things. Prabhupada was so focused on Krishna that he didn't identify so much with the material world. Like Hari Sori, who was Prabhupada's personal servant, described that Prabhupada had a swollen cheek one day. So Hari Sori said, Prabhupada, you have a toothache? And Prabhupada said, yes, some discomfort. And that was all. He never mentioned it again. Prabhupada never brought it up again. I mean, you try that when you have a toothache, you know? It's not so easy, huh? I mean, every 3 minutes you have to sort of go like, and everyone goes, oh, you have a toothache. Because we need this sympathy, you know what I mean? We need all the people around us to sort of suffer with us. Oh no, you're going through all of this, really? Oh. We need that constant support, that emotional support, that people share our suffering. So we are like, we go into it, you know, like, yeah, there's this cheek and it's swollen and the tooth is just throbbing, boom, and the mind just becomes a tooth, right? The mind is just a tooth. The whole consciousness is in the tooth. There's nothing else. The universe has become a tooth. But we can see that for Prabhupada that was not the case. That didn't happen. Right? His mind didn't go in the tooth. His mind stayed with Krishna. And therefore he could tolerate it without painkillers and anything, which is to us inconceivable. Right? An intense toothache without painkillers is very tough. But Prabhupada could do, because he was so absorbed in the spiritual world. So that's the idea. And Bhagavatam is waking us up to that. Bhagavatam is awakening that kind of vision, the vision of the spiritual world, the spiritual reality. And one begins to see like that. So in this way, the Bhagavatam is more than just a book. It's like it gives us an outlook. Now, in this age, the Bhagavad was given in a written form, but previously it was in spoken form. And whether it was every time as the Bhagavatam was spoken, was verbatim the same, as if a tape recorder was being played, I don't think so. There was some flexibility. It was the same narratives, the same stories, but not necessarily exactly the same word. Although there were obviously verses, and people were srutidar, and people were remembering when they heard once. But Vyasadev, it is said, at the beginning of the age of Kali, begins to write down all the Vedas. Before that, they're orally delivered. And then he begins to write it down so that everyone can just get access to it. So when Lord Brahma heard the Srimad Bhagavatam in the form of four verses, then when did it go from four verses to 18,000? When that same knowledge was spoken to Lord Brahma, from Lord Brahma to Narada, was it spoken in four verses or was it spoken in 18,000 verses? So some questions like that I cannot answer to you. I cannot answer. I can only ask them. But the questions are relevant and they are interesting also, and we can therefore it wouldn't be awkward to say that different sages made some contribution to the growth of the 18,000 verses. In the heavenly planets, the same Bhagavatam exist in 100,000 verses? Are we missing out? Oh my God. You know, what about the other 82,000 verses? Oh no. Eh? Oh gosh. Gee. You know, there may be a lot of information that we are missing. Yeah. Maybe we should send someone to the heavenly planets, one devotee, and then come back and tell us the real thing. So, 4 verses, 18,000 verses, 100,000 verses, doesn't matter so much. Because the essence is all the same. The same essence. The very same essence, the same description about the eternal supreme personality of Godhead, who manifests the material world and then manifests in the material world, performs so many pastimes, so many incarnations, and so on. And in each of these incarnations, here the chapter is called scheduled incarnations. So now we're getting scheduled incarnations. Incarnations that come regularly. And then as you read more and more about it, then you read that the Lord keeps on appearing in the same forms, like Varaha, in the form of a boar. The Lord comes in the form of a boar when the earth falls and picks it up from a lower region. And he appears many times in that form of a boar. And they go, doesn't that get boring? You know? Keeps on appearing in the form of a boar. Doesn't it get boring at one point? Why does he appear again and again in the same forms? It's sort of puzzling the mind. But then we find that Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur explains that he is relating to when he appears in this world, he is appearing in a strategic way, relating to the consciousness of the living being. As the living beings develop particular mentalities, the Lord responds to that mentality. So we are like developing the boar-like mentality, looking in the garbage. And then the Lord appears as a transcendental boar for Hiranyaksha, who was looking. And Hiranyaksha was looking for gold. That was Hiranyaksha. Hiranyaksha was interested in gold. And it's like somehow or other his whole focus was taking gold out of the earth. And he was quite expert at it. And as a result, it is said that actually if you take all the minerals out of the earth, then it upsets the balance of the earth. So Hiranyaksha was such a good gold digger that he took all the gold out of the earth, and the result was that the earth lost its balance and then fell down to lower regions. So then the Lord appears as a boar. Right? Now it's very interesting because he appears as a boar to tell Hiranyaksha something. He responds to the mentality of Hiranyaksha. Boars are looking, basically digging in the dirt. So that's what Hiranyaksha is doing, digging in the dirt, looking for some abominable thing. Yes? You're looking for gold, looking for an abominable thing. See? So in reciprocation, he held up a mirror to his consciousness by appearing in the form of the boar. So this is what is explained by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and how the different incarnations, therefore, are a response to the mentality of the living being. And these mentalities are predictable. They are the same. Because punapunas charvita charvinanam, life after life, we become conditioned in the same way. And yes, here is a young person discovering the world. Oh, and I am gonna find my own unique way in life. Okay, good luck. Good luck to you. As time goes on, you find out that it wasn't that unique after all. Actually, it wasn't that unique after all. Just like you meet people in the street who sort of say, when you present Krishna consciousness, that they have their own philosophy. And then you ask him what it is, and then it's usually, it's all one. Well, I can only say to that, really, you thought of all of that all by yourself? Wow. You know, it's a philosophy that's totally dead. We've heard it 1,000 times over, 1,000,000 times over, endless, the same conclusion. Because when you start speculating about spirit, what will you come up with? Spirit is not matter. That's intelligent. Then, therefore, the qualities that are not in matter, or the qualities that are in matter, cannot be in spirit. That's logical. Then when there's form in matter, there can be no form in spirit. Congratulations, you have just managed to reach the Mayavad conclusion. Very expert, and you've just realized that the truth is formless, and with you, zillions and trillions of others have reached the same incomplete conclusion. And there you go.
Because
why do you think that with your pea brain you can figure out the absolute truth? Aren't you overestimating your own intelligence?
No. Because
the sages have said, Pantastu koti sattavatsara sampragamyo vayora tapi manaso munipongavanam so pyasti yat prapadi chintya vichintya tattvi govindamari purusam tamaham bhajami. That with the intellect one can never capture the truth. It is not possible. Even the biggest philosophers, sometimes it's amazing how close they got, but then they also missed it. Someone like Kant, you know, such an amazing intellectual, really. What he all didn't think about, all by himself, quite impressive. But at the end, didn't quite get it, although he got close. And so many philosophers, because no one can conceive of Krishna. Because Krishna goes beyond our imagination. One cannot imagine. What would God be like?
Blue.
No, even if you would think about it, right? Blue. What color blue? Now you want the color as well. You're asking a bit much, you know. But who would have thought, like, blackish blue, like a rain cloud. Sham, who could think of that? That supreme lord. And how this darkness of Krishna is showing Krishna's mysterious nature. Krishna's pastimes are also covered by some darkness, it is said. Yes. Darkness surrounds Krishna. Because Krishna is not so easily known. Krishna is not so easily known. The pastimes of Krishna are covered by dust, and you cannot just see them. So with our own intelligence, we'll never figure it out. So there's a different process, and Bhagavatam reveals it to us. The process is you serve Krishna, you attract his mercy by your service, and then he reveals himself. And as he begins to reveal himself, you can know him. Only then. Otherwise, you can't know him. And that's a whole different approach. Instead of conquering, instead of like the conqueror who goes forward and with the sharpness of his intellect cuts right through ignorance, and mankind makes so much progress, you know. I mean, once upon a time, you know, dear students, once upon a time, man used to think that the earth was flat. Of course, you know, I mean, they didn't have much information in those days, and actually, in a way, it was quite intelligent, you know, but due to poor information, they didn't know, right? But nowadays, of course, we know everything, practically speaking. I mean, no, really. I mean, it happens to be so, right? Just at this very moment, that mankind has come to its greatest moment of glory. Never ever in time did mankind know as much as we know today. What a coincidence that we just happened to live at that time. Yeah. Isn't it amazing? Yes. Just now, it is this moment that we know more than everything. But, and yes, isn't it that within the ocean of nescience, science is like an island, vast, vast in all directions, like a continent. It's like a continent. But I would like to offer that it's not only like a continent, it's a drifting continent, as continents appear to do, a drifting continent. And as we are discovering more and more, day by day, scientific discoveries, we at the same time forget the knowledge of the past. Who knows about grandmother's herbs? I don't know. Grandmothers knew how to go into forests and pick all kinds of things from that forest. You know. Don't ask me. I don't know. All that knowledge is now forgotten. So how much is forgotten? So we make progress in one direction and forget in the other. What kind of knowledge is that? So, not making progress, really. But Bhagavatam is totally different. It is not based on man conquering and just on his power. It is based on the mercy of the Supreme Lord. So the whole attitude has to change. Instead of becoming more and more powerful, our attitude has to become one of dependence and of humility and on admitting our insignificance rather than our greatness. In the material world, it is the sharpness of your intellect. Intellect is razor sharp, razor sharp. And it's sharpened by 5 PhDs. In this way, it becomes so sharp, it cuts right through everything. It's like Stephen Hawking, it's just amazing what his intellect cannot deal with, as an example of that. So it's about power. The way of the Bhagavat is actually the way of realizing how insignificant we are, how dependent we are at every step in life, and that knowledge depends on the Supreme Lord. So it is the way of life of becoming humble, of becoming submissive, instead of challenging and rebellious, and it is the life of becoming servant. Servant means to adjust to the master. That servant, sannyasis are having assistants, and once I had an assistant who was trying to serve me, and at one point he said, that was not this one that Janani was, by the way, no, just to make sure, it was another one. But he said to me, why don't you cooperate? I'm trying to serve you. There I go. Do with this, So servant means to adjust, to make the adjustment. So it's not easy at all, but that is the way of the Bhagavatam, and then. Only then can we see. Only then can we see when we actually adjust. And the more humble we become, then we can actually begin to understand things as they are. And that is why Srila Prabhupada sometimes points out that academics, they can't know. They can't know. And just dismisses them. And then we think, but they know a lot. They do. They know a lot. But even although they know a lot, still, they cannot know the absolute truth as it is, because no one can know unless it is revealed by Krishna. And that is ultimately the only way to know the truth. So this kind of humility, and humility is something alien, you know, in the modern world. I saw, you know, that we had a comic in Holland. I did this TV thing once. I saw it as a kid, but it made an impression upon me. And it was a man, a simple man, you know. He had a cap on, a labor type, you know. And he was coming for a job interview. And this job interview was happening in a big hall. And there was the man, the interviewer, was sitting behind glass with a screen, so you couldn't see him. But his voice was coming out of the wall with a loudspeaker. And the voice was saying, name. And the man said his name, and then he said, thank you very much, please. You know, and every time, every question, he answered it, and then he said, thank you very much, please. Thank you very much, please. And he looked like a total fool. Yeah? Yeah. But actually, if you think about it, he was very humble, actually. And the other man was like just very cold and arrogant. But this humility was depicted as like, you know, you become like a fool when you're humble, you know, when you're simple. You know, very simple, then you're a total fool. So the whole world projects this upon us, you know, that like you're a fool when you're simple. Even when you're a devotee, you know, like it haunts us. It still haunts us, you know. Like, I mean, how many slokas do you know? Seven. Only seven? My God, you know. How can you know only seven slokas? That's all I can remember. Who can be so simple to say, you know, like, so that pressure, that social pressure upon us is the whole world where you're supposed to be greater than you are, right? It comes into every field. And then in the modern world, it also came into the field of sex, you know, because ordinary sex will not do. It has to be super sex, right? Only you have to be a super lover. And if you're not a super lover, you're a loser. Right? And that's the image that is being projected. So you have to be, ladies have to be extremely, all have to be totally like a model. Right? All skinny and beautiful and this, that. And men have to be like muscular and powerful. And you know, what do you do when you have like, as a guy, and your shoulders are sort of hanging down, you're not broad-shouldered. Oh, God. You know, and you go weightlifting, and it just doesn't do anything, right? you do weightlifting, and you get like a few little, you know, little lumps on your arm, you know. And it's just no real muscle developing. It's like, oh my God, you know, you get suicidal, right? Start thinking, you know, like, oh no, you know. Yeah. So all this pressure also exists in spiritual life, you know. It's like, I mean, how you're folding your dhoti and everything, you know what I mean? The size of your beads, the size of your neck beads, you know. What kind of shoes you're wearing? I hope they're like, you know, I mean, either Birkenstocks or, you know, I mean, something. Yeah, it's like, you don't have Birkenstocks. I mean, God, you know, what kind of devotee are you, you know? I mean, you know, are you advanced? You know, I don't think, you're probably a neophyte wearing only plastic toe slippers, you know. You just started out in spiritual life. Gosh, it's amazing, right? How much we have? In Holland about 500 years ago, there was a famous writer named Erasmus. He was also a scientist, and he wrote this book in English it translates as the praise of folly, or, you know, the glory of foolishness. And the whole book is about foolishness, yeah? And about how people are just worshipping foolishness, and everyone is part of it, and everyone is trying to look greater than they are, and it just looks so foolish. And then they speak about the monks who wear like special belts with golden hasps on it and special sandals. And I was thinking, yes, Birkenstocks. And I can recommend it. You can download it, Praise of Folly, from the internet. You can download it. And you read the chapter about the monks. And I tell you, it's like you don't have to change much, you know. You just change ISKCON. You just write ISKCON. Wherever it describes the monastery and the monks, you write ISKCON. It's all about us. He holds up a perfect mirror, right, of how much we get controlled by the externals. So, because the Bhagavad reality is so alien to us, so different than the world where you always have to live up to some image. In the Bhagavad, you're meant to actually be what you really are, a klutz, right? That's the truth. Everyone is a klutz, right? A klutz is a person with two left hands. A klutz is someone who just, you know, is lucky when it works out, fingers crossed. A klutz is someone, Even a simple thing, you can blow it, you know. The klutz did it again. That is the nature of the conditioned soul, who has four defects, and one is imperfect senses. And we blow it again and again. And thus, life is a chain of mistakes. Right? Life is a chain of mistakes. And when finally we get to the point where we admit this, you know, actually my life is a chain, an endless chain of mistakes, that when finally come to the point of admitting it, then we become truthful. And then humility begins to actually manifest. And suddenly we become ready to take shelter of Krishna. So the Srimad Bhagavatam brings about a transformation in our mentality. It gradually brings us to that point of humility and to that point of service, and simultaneously it begins to introduce more and more about the Supreme Lord. So as we are learning how to become a servant and how to acknowledge our lack of qualification, we are at the same time, Bhagavatam presents us more and more about the Supreme Lord. So by the time you come to the 10th canto, you're supposed to have become a little humble, so that you can actually appreciate the glory of Krishna. That's the idea of the Bhagavatam. Leave it at that. Any questions? Sometimes when we do our service, we can't be humble because we have to do the job nicely. Our definition of humble is that when you're humble, that you have to speak very soft. You know, today I have been asked to speak on the Bhagavatam, and although I'm not qualified and very fallen, and actually not able to speak at all, somehow or other, I'm sitting here by the will. there's no one who minds that I'm sitting here, but if anybody minds, you know, then I will not speak at all. And I'm almost finished with my introduction. Oh, geez, the time of the Bhagavatam class is over. So we have an artificial idea of what humility means. That humility means I have to be soft-spoken. My hands have to be glued together with super glue, and you know, sort of always walk as if you think the sky can fall on your head. So it shows that we are still actors. You see, like I was describing, in the material world, everyone is an actor. Everyone's trying to live up to an image. So, and I told that we bring it into spiritual life. So it shows that, like, when we're still acting out, oh, I'm humble now, I'm going to be humble. Yes, Prabhu. Would it be all right? And we just learn a certain vocabulary and so on. But inside, we're not humble at all. You see? And real humility means honesty. Prabhupada was very humble, right? And yet he could roar like a lion. Yeah? But a humble lion. Prabhupada could be worshipped. And I like that picture of Prabhupada seated on a silver throne, a monster of a throne. A very huge silver throne in India somewhere. In Gujarat, actually. It's an enormous thing. And he's sitting on there. And then his hands are sort of folded. His head is a little tilted. And on his face, there is an expression which says, at least I read that on his face. The face is very humble and says, I know. It's a monster of a throne. How can any human being sit on a throne like this? I know, I know. It's outrageous. He said, but what can I do? I have to. It's my duty. So that people can recognize who is the teacher. Who has the truth. Therefore I have to do this. And Prabhupada has this kind of humble, apologetic expression. Even while he's sitting on this throne. So it's not an act. It must be a real feeling. And then there is no problem. Then one can scream in humility. One can bang his fist on the table in humility. And I'm saying that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Bang, bang. Very humble. Yeah. Humility means not claim any glory for ourselves. And give all the glory to others. So one can bang his fist on the tables when you give all the glory to Krishna. Lakshman introduced Lord Ramachandra. And he said, this is Ramachandra. He has appeared in the glorious Raghu dynasty. He is the prince of Ayodhya, the Yuvaraj, the crown prince. And he described all the glories of Lord Ram. And then Lakshman is his brother. So indirectly, you know, I mean, if you glorify your brother, you're also glorifying yourself, right? I mean, he comes from the greatest family and very aristocratic, amazing family. And, you know, very rich, wealthy, influential, and, you know, like important and so on. And that's him, and I'm his brother. But that's not what Lakshman said. After introducing Lord Ramachandra and glorifying him, Lakshman said, and I am his servant. See? So in this way, that's humility. Not claiming any glory for whatever we've done. But Prabhupada sometimes would even claim, you know, would even claim and say, yes, yes, nobody was as successful as I am. Yeah?
And I say, was he proud? No, no, not falsely proud. Proud simply of Krishna. And that, yes, it all worked out nicely, but not thinking any of my qualification, all the mercy of Krishna. And Prabhupada said, and if you see any good quality in me, right, then you should think, just like the moon is reflecting the light of the sun, the moon has no light of its own, so if you see any good quality in me, then know it to be the reflection of the good qualities of my spiritual master. Because I only acted upon his order. So actually the glory goes to him. It was his order. And in many cases we know like that. You know, it's like I experienced that one day, in those days I was Bhavananda's disciple. Bhavananda Prabhu's disciple. He stood behind me. And out of nowhere, and he said, now, do you like construction? And I felt impending doom, you know? And I said, I was trying to get out of it. I was saying, not really. He said, great, you're in charge of all the construction in Mayapur. And it was as someone hit me on the head with a hammer, and it was like, and I was kind of, in my mind, sort of thinking, what does that mean? Or which project? So many projects. The samadhi did. So many. Slowly it dawned upon me. I was in charge of all that. What to say? And I did it. Right? And then later, people glorified me for it. I said, you know, he did this service. But now I'll tell you the truth. I hated it. I hated it. I was like, every moment, I was like, oh God, why do I have to do this? Bricks, cement, steel, you know, dealing with Muslims all day. I'm a preacher. You know, it's hard to preach to a Muslim, you know what I mean? It's hard to preach to bricks. It's hard to preach to steel. I can, you know. It's like I said, oh, how can I do this service? Oh, it's too much. I want to go. Oh. But I didn't, and I carried on. And now I get glorified for it. Right? But actually, there's no glory that's mine at all, because I was reluctant every step of the way. And the only reason why I did it was because if you disobey the order of the spiritual master, that's the third offense against the holy name, and it destroys your spiritual life. So therefore, I didn't see any way out. I was caught in the situation, and I just did it because I had to. Now that's the truth. Yeah, what to do? See? So like this, the glory really goes to the spiritual master, nothing to us. Like that. So just if we're honest, then humility automatically follows. Humility and honesty are practically the same. Thank you very much, Shri Prabhupada.